Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Well, it's been a glorious 2 weeks here in the UK as wave after wave of Tory corruption scandals wash across the nation and even reach as far as the mainstream media. It's been very nice to see the Daily Mail sticking the knife into the Johnson and the Tories and the Express and the BBC and Channel 4 and everyone's having a go, really. So it's been very nice. I have a commentator that I particularly like who always puts out a video at 6 a.m. in the morning, and I've even been waking up early feeling quite excited about what he's going to talk about next, because every video is about the next thing and then the next thing, then gives the Tories an absolute battering day after day. And this was really kicked off by the Owen Paterson scandal and the corruption and the paid lobbying, and it's like the Tory wrecking ball just hasn't stopped rolling since then. So I just hope that the mainstream media have really turned on the Tories, and this isn't just a flash in the pan. But we will see. The thing we want to talk about today is something that I noticed on Navarra Media yesterday, and Pete's been seen it's this quite a lot being mentioned on Twitter. And this is the statements from an MP, a Tory MP called Andrew Rosendale, to do with the second job problem. And there's two statements, one about the Tory MPs and then one about the recent cut to universal credit, and the contrast and the way he talks about these two things is you're just there with your mouth hanging open. It's absolutely astonishing. So I'll hand you over to Pete. If you just talk about what this little worm had to say.
Yeah, with pleasure. This is a very typical case, and it's useful to us because it exposes the world view of, well, at least one Tory MP, and probably of a whole lot of politicians of his ilk. I don't think it's unreasonable to think that they do have similar thoughts. In fact, you don't have to do much investigation to just really ascertain that is how that class of people think.
Yeah, about, so it's right on the surface. Not trying to hide it or anything.
Other people. And what it shows are sort of class attitudes and ideological class war. Now, I do keep saying we have to sort of not be too squeamish about this term, class war or class struggle. It's real. It's probably more real than a lot of culture war stuff, which can be over whether you eat avocados or not. You know, and we can have a great big bust up about avocados, but get all kind of prissy and picky when people mention class, because it's like not very nice and not very polite. But class looms very fucking large. We ignore giving a class analysis and understanding economic class and class antagonism at our peril. And there's a great deal of propaganda goes into getting us to do that very thing and for it not to be quite respectable or not quite nice. But these utterances of Andrew Rosendale MP really, really just throw into very sharp relief the Tory worldview of a kind of a middling sort of Tory. And he said, when questioned in the lobby by a journalist, I don't think it might have been a BBC journalist, about whether MPs should have second jobs or not, because this is what the debate is coming down to now. Should they even have second jobs? Shouldn't they be giving all their energy to representing their constituents? And Rosendale concedes the point. He says, yes, of course, this must be the primary concern of an MP. He says, but nevertheless, we are dealing with human beings who have families and responsibilities. In other words, implying that the 82k a year and fucking unlimited expenses, you know, is not enough. And because the poor little MPs need a bit of extra money to kind of keep ticking out, because they have to, after all, they have to travel to London. If you know you're the MP for Stirling in Scotland, you keep a flat in London. But some of these characters are climbing six figures of expenses, you know, and all manner of shit. You know, and you can look it up. You can go and actually look at the expenses list and see what they claim. And there have been scandals about this before, given some of the preposterous claims. You have the duck houses and having the moat cleaned of your stately home, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And this kind of shit. So this character is claiming that the poor little hard done to MP is having a terrible, terrible time managing on 82,000 a year. How would you get on with that? How would you fancy like 82k a year?
And he also said that, you know, they we have to be very mindful of that they might need to change their lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, their lifestyle.
Yeah, well, if they can't do their second jobs, like Pattison, who earned 200k from his second jobs, you know. And sometimes these second jobs pay millions, you know, a few hours a week, fantastic rate of pay. And it's obvious that they're being paid for their influence and their insider knowledge. You know, they can kind of get into the detail of the actual rules, you know, and find little ways round and evasions. But that's what all this is about. It's about paying for their MP's influence and their contacts, you know, and for their insider knowledge.
But it's not that they would be hard done by in any way, or they would they would cause them any suffering to have less of all this this slimy money coming their way.
Yeah.
It would just affect. We must, with a serious tone here, we really must consider that they might have to change their lifestyle. Yeah. Just remember that, what I've just said there, when we come on to what he says about people on Universal Credit.
Well, I put it here like diddums, you know. Poor little hard done to MP, you have to change your lifestyle. So I've got to kind of say, well, what about somebody who at the beginning of the pandemic on Universal Credit got awarded an extra 20 quid to make up for the fact that life at that bottom end of the economy got 10 times more difficult as a result of the COVID lockdowns and so forth, and infections and all the rest of it, and the impact that the pandemic had on the economy. And so, okay, fair enough, they get bung them an extra 20 quid. But now, of course, they're saying, well, it was only a temporary measure, we're taking it back. But of course, people have got used to it. B, we have now got inflation at 5% and massive increases in fuel prices and quite large increases in a lot of food prices. And now that £20 being taken away is really having a catastrophic effect on people who relied upon it. But this character, this Andrew Rosingdale, had some things to say about that. He said that on the £20 Universal Credit that was removed, he says, well, maybe they don't need it.
What he said was, I think they like it, but perhaps they don't really need it. They just like it. They were just buying some extra Kit Kats with it, really.
That's right, yeah. But of course, one commentator says, well, are you giving them 20 quid? It's just going to go onto crack dens and betting offices. You know, it's there it is, you know, the undeserving poor. So they'll spend it on gin, you know, they'll spend it on crack these days.
Right? Oh, yeah, they wouldn't be using it to actually sort of like pay their rent or feed their kids or anything ridiculous like that,
I mean, and there is enormous hardship at that kind of like lower income
especially now, and the cost of living is rocketing up.
And also, I see a lot of people receiving Universal Credit are actually in work, and that Universal Credit is subbing their employers so that they don't have to pay proper wages that people can live on. They basically are having a sub from the government, we will say the taxpayer, you know, which is the government really, but it's our money.
Mm-hmm.
We're the people. Tell me it's not our money, you know. But it's, people say, well, it ain't going to the crack den and the
The betting office.
In the betting office. It's going to the employer who can then increase his profits by paying rock-bottom wages.
Yeah.
So that's how a lot of that operates. But of course he said that. We said they don't need it. Said, anyway, there are different types of people. All their circumstances are different. So some of them might need it, but some of them might not.
He never said that. He never admitted that some of them might need it.
He never used that
term at all, and very carefully avoided the word need.
Yeah. Now, when he was talking about changing the MPs' arrangements for their second jobs, he'd say, well, if we are going to change it, it needs to be evolutionary so that they can accommodate, you know, not have to change their lifestyles overnight. When it comes to universal credit, that was an overnight change. You know, they voted and it, bang, gone. That wasn't fucking evolutionary, was it? Nice and gradual and convenient.
No.
For somebody living on £500 a month or £300 a month, as opposed to somebody on £82k a year. What is that? That's like, I don't know, £1,500 a week. So what is it? It's like a lot of money. You know. Of course, he couldn't avoid the economically illiterate line that, in fact, what the words he used, he said, you know, the government has an overall national responsibility regarding spending. In other words, all this crap about the deficit. 20 people knock off these 20 quids. I mean, if you work out how much it is, compared with, say, the 30-odd billion that Serco conned out of the public for track and trace and didn't deliver.
It's a drop in the ocean compared to the people on universal credit over COVID.
Yeah.
It's just a drop in the ocean to the money that they've creamed off for their pals.
Now, we're using this to try and discern a kind of a thought pattern or a worldview or a mindset, whatever that you want to call it. And it is that there is a difference between MPs, professional class, managerial, you know, people, okay, they receive a salary, but their basic business is managing the capitalist economy and the capitalist society and basically, you know, managing the mob on behalf of the capitalists. That is what their job is. And they are a class of people with this privilege, you know. And you see it with this guy, this Andrew Rosingdale, is that there's a presumption of class privilege on his part. This is an intrinsically privileged person. They believe themselves to be privileged, to do with upbringing, education, class position, the way that you learn, whole sets of useful manners if you belong to that class. And you can see that it's internalised with him. There is a special case and we've got to look after the poor MPs, you know, might have to change their lifestyle. But the poor, the rabble, the numbers on a spreadsheet over the working class can be expected.
Just there to be used.
You're kind of factory fodder, you know, or Deliveroo fodder or Amazon warehouse fodder. That's what you are, you know. And you're just a number on a spreadsheet. And you can take a massive pay cut overnight. £20.
A week.
A week, you know. And you think, what can you do with the £20? No, but if you're earning £82,000, £20 is like small change in your pocket.
Yeah.
If you're on an absolute subsistence level and your food prices are going up every week and your gas bill's gone up, being able
to kind of pay your gas bill and not.
Yeah, or your rent and not and all the rest of it. And it does get absolutely hairy for people.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that kind of really like jumps out so much for me is like in the tone he used in the two interviews. So when he's talking about the MPs, serious face, you know, and saying, well, and being the understanding and kind of compassionate and saying, we must understand that the MPs are human beings with families.
Yeah.
Now, when it came to talking about the people on the low income, they're not human beings with families.
No.
Never mentioned. But he didn't use serious face there. He was kind of smirking. in the way that he presented it, almost like a little bit jovial, a bit jokey, very serious when talking about any slight inconvenience to his pals in the Tory party. But when it comes to the people claiming universal credit, oh, you know, they're all a bit of a joke, really, aren't they? And it was about, he said, he said it with a bit of a smile where, oh, well, I know they really like to have the extra 20 quid, but maybe they don't really need it. And he actually said it with a bit of a cheeky smile. Oh, they don't really need it, you know, like this. And it's like the contrast, because the way I think Navarra Media actually did a very good job with this, in the way that they played the two clips sort of next to each other. And it was
smart.
It really was just... just disgusting, absolutely disgusting. I mean, it really showed just exactly the, as you said, the attitude is that, you know, that all these people on universal credit are not human beings with families.
Yeah,
they're not as important as the MPs who need this extra kind of half a million quid a year.
Yeah, because they're only in the top 5% regarding their salary at 82k. That's the top 5%.
Yeah.
Only the top 5% of this country earn 82k or more, and they're in it.
Now, this clip has gone viral, hasn't it? So I
think
saw
it did,
on Twitter, though. They spliced them together, these two statements, just it to is. Kind it's, of really getting, draw out the contrast.
It's getting quite a lot of exposure, and as has the whole kind of corruption.
So a lot of people are really angry about aren't they?
The whole corruption scenario is getting a lot of exposure, and the lying... You know, and then the corruption, which corruption and lying go, you know, hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, Peter Stefanovic's montage of Boris Johnson lying through his teeth in Parliament has now hit 40 million views. 40 million views.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it is, I think it is cutting through now, but I mean, we'll see. You don't want to get... I would urge a bit of caution. I mean, a bit of schadenfreude goes a long way these days, in these dark times.
It does. It's cheering me up.
It's cheering you up. But it's, you know, they've got... It's 2 or 3 years to any general election, and a lot can happen. A lot can happen by tomorrow.
Of course.
A lot can happen by the end of next week.
Yeah.
But the beautiful thing about this is how it just exposes that attitude.
Yeah.
And it exposes the way it's internalised, because the guy's got no... You watch him delivering these two items.
It's just shameless. Shameless, isn't he, the way he says it.
He's not self-aware. He's not aware of his own privilege, you know. He's not aware that he thinks that these are completely different fucking species. You know, the working class, the Victorians called them hands, you know. It's an exact lot of people. No, they're hands, because, you know. You know, or employees, or labour, in the abstract, not real people, flesh and blood, going and working day in and day out at the shittiest jobs in very many instances, but like labour, abstract, or hands, abstract. And this is completely internalised with this guy. He has no self-consciousness. And he believes that his attitude is completely natural and not a thing that's been formed by his education, or his upbringing, or his class position. And all the manners that he acquired, I don't know whether he's a working class kid made good or what the hell he is. I don't know anything about the guy. But you could see that those attitudes are just completely internalised. You know. And this is something we need to try and understand.
So the question that we were talking about this morning in relation to all this, how far can the Tories go before... they're over, before people realise that they've been lied to, and they're just so angry that not only are they not going to vote for them and vote for somebody else, but maybe they even manage to push them out before there's an election. So how far do things have to go?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, isn't it? And you will hear me say over and over again that... somewhat rhetorically, that the political question, the question of political philosophy is why do slaves acquiesce in their slavery? Why do serfs acquiesce in their serfdom? Why do wage slaves acquiesce? Well, we all think we've got to, you know, we want to survive, etc., etc. But why do people vote for parties and politicians who are so obviously operating against their interests? And yet
oh, it's still... to get Brexit done, didn't you know?
Yeah, they'll still vote for them. And, of course, so there's a call there for an understanding of the way propaganda works, for the way ideology works, what its detail is. And you've got obviously a fascinating study, you know. And of course, not only on working people or the mass of people or the mob, if you want to call it that, the way they it can be sort of quite conservative and quite faithful to their masters and be, you know, really quite into their forelock tugging and cap doffing and so forth. But also on the other side, how does somebody like this Rossingdell end up how he is, you know, and taking it as just utterly natural, the order of things, the order of the world, the God-given divine order, that there is one type of creature, and the working class who can manage without the extra 20 quid, there are another type of creature. So it works all the way around, you know. So, and I think a lot of sort of reductionist, old-fashioned lefties don't like the idea that you'd have to have some understanding of the psyche, you know. How does this stuff get inside people? How does it operate when it's in there? How does it come from the inside back to the outside in action, in attitudes, in criminal behaviour, in violence, in street violence, in protest or whatever? It's just a never-ending source of amazement is how much the British public and the American public and the European public will put up with. They seem to be able to put up with endless fucking abuse. And they come back for more. They are like people with Stockholm Syndrome, you know. And it reminds me that Tolstoy, who's got himself a big dose of religion after an existential crisis... But Tolstoy was a count, right, and he owned vast estates in the Russian heartland and had loads and loads of serfs because feudalism wasn't abandoned in Russia until halfway through the 19th century. It's kind of abandoned it over here, like, much, much earlier, you know. But Tolstoy had serfs, and because he kind of got religion and all kinds of guilt about stuff he'd done to these subjected people, he decided to give them their freedom, you know. He said, you are no longer, you know, held in bondage to the estate. Go. And the serfs said, no, we've got nowhere to go. Where shall we go?
Oh, yeah.
Our families have lived on this land for generations.
You need more than freedom, don't you, really? Yeah.
Well, they turned around and said to him, no, we want to stay captive.
We want to stay where we can actually, sleep somewhere where we don't freeze to death and have some food.
Well, I mean, he would have had to say, well, here's the land and here, and you can keep your house. I don't know to what extent that he went, but they weren't psychologically able to get their heads around about not being serfs is what the nub of the story is. All right? And I think it's a deeper question and a more difficult question than we realise, but you can see there's no escaping from it here, you know. Now, quite how far the unrest is going, the Tories have fallen a little bit behind in the polls. No thanks to Labour, that's offering virtually no opposition. I mean, Starmer's had a go on the corruption and the jobs thing. He's had a bit of a go and a little bit of a shout at parliamentary question time. But really, you know, no policies, no clear pro-working class agenda, you know. And Starmer's been anointed by Rupert Murdoch, who allowed him to write a column in The Sun. So you can see what's going on here. I mean, the powers that be have realised months ago, and we spotted this before anybody else, you heard it here first, folks, that little by little, in a gradual way, so it's nothing too sudden, no big dramas, but slowly, One little shade at a time, the MSM have been turning on Johnson and his immediate coterie. They're now in full flight against them. Rees-Mogg's up for question, and well, just God knows, just loads of Tory MPs, you know, who had jobs and were taking money for basically lobbying. we know for sure that it is biting in some way, but it's partly the fact that the powers that be and their agents in the gutter press have realised that Johnson at some point will become a liability. That his affable cheek...
At some point.
Yeah, but at some point. But they're getting ready for it.
Yeah.
They'll be getting ready for it. So they looks... Because they want to be on the right side of history.
Yeah.
They don't want to make a sudden volte face. It's not going to... They have a reputation too, even though it might seem surprising given how deep down in the gutter these characters get, you know. So,
like my outburst there was like he was a liability when he was the mayor of London, for God's sake. He was a liability when he was like lying in the Telegraph.
Well, it shows, of course, yeah. twice sacked for lying. Sacked as foreign secretary because he was pathetic.
So my outburst really was just that he's always been a liability. I mean, he was a liability when he was the mayor of London.
And the
cock-ups and the corruption that he was engaging in way back.
And yet,
he's always been a liability, hasn't he? But he just can turn a good lie with a cheeky smile. So
well, I would say, and yet, the affability has still kept him in the lead in the posts, and his personal popularity ratings have stayed ahead of any opposition and stayed quite good from his point of view.
Yeah.
Despite the absolute incompetence on COVID, the corruption which we've been aware of forever, the broken promises, recent ones, you know, Northern Ireland, no border in the Irish Sea, ha ha. HS2 turning round and saying to the North, well, we're not going to actually press it on to Sheffield. We'll upgrade some of the existing 19th century track. So there's a lot of disappointment in the North, the Red Wall, you know, about that. So, and the poor management of the economy and inflation creeping up, stagnant wages, increasing fuel prices.
Oh, don't forget the disaster of Brexit.
The entire disaster of Brexit, which is multifaceted. And yet still the guy stays in the lead because all on the strength of his affable persona.
Yeah.
And you tell me that ideology isn't messing with people's brains, right? And that we need to understand that. I don't think it's the whole story. You need your class analysis. You need to understand material base. And working conditions and modes of production, relationships of production, produce outcomes, political outcomes, and class attitudes, and all the rest of it. You need to understand that. But there's a psychological aspect to this as well, and I think that's the deep question you need to dig into. And there's a lot of ins and outs on that, which I'm dealing with under Freud. I'm dealing with under fascism over time. And I think that these inquiries will go on for years if I've managed to stay alive. So, but bear in mind, that's a core question as far as I can see. At the moment, I think it's correct to say that there is a lot of resentment. There is a lot of anger. There is a lot of demoralisation. There is a lot of depression. And that's filtering through into mental health consequences going on out there. And one of the things that I see is that people are drawing the wrong conclusions from a few true premises. You know, and this is how the right operates. It makes you jump to the wrong conclusion, even though you've identified something very true. I mean, what has been identified is that governments do bad things, and politicians are very frequently corrupt, globally and historically. Corporations do bad things. And in our current situation, corporations completely in bed with the government, as we demonstrated in our podcast on Serco and the way Serco is basically writing policy about outsourcing. So governments and corporations do bad things. We know that, and that is very, very widely understood. But instead, people are being either demoralised by that and refusing to be active, or not finding the will to be active, or they blame the wrong people, and they are, you know, the carrot of the other is dangled in front of angry people to deflect the anger away from the real culprits, which is the government and which is the corporations they serve. Over onto foreigners and immigrants and Muslims and minorities and gay people and trans people and any kind of divide and real feud you can start with a big culture war jobby. You go for it, you know. Take the knee, don't take the knee, etc. You know, immigrants, a few tens of people coming over on boats, you know, the RNLI. And there's this whole kind of deflection game, all this propaganda manoeuvre in the business. Very, very easy. Once you know where to spot it, you will see it. And it's obvious, and it's plain, and it's objectively fucking real. So that's what's going on there. And a further point I want to make about it is that none of this is new. It's not new. It's it in the news now, but it's not new. It's not like a few rotten eggs in the barrel. It's not like a few who can't help putting their trout in, can't help putting their snout in the trough. And being an MP gives ample opportunities. These are the people that pass the laws, that make a law to allow themselves to do anything if they want to. Because what they decide collectively becomes the law.
Mm.
So very dangerous temptations to corruption. But it's just coming to light now. It's been ever thus. And it goes deeper than people think. And again, I would urge you to go back over the podcast and find the podcast I did about Serco and the role of the Serco's own think tank in basically writing policy, you know. And we know that we've got the state in the UK is completely enmeshed with the corporations, global corporations. The case of Big Oil, which I recently mugged up on through that book, Crude Britannia, by Terry McAllister and another geezer whose name I still can't remember. Excellent book. Give it a read. Very readable. Quite poetic in part. Very thorough investigation of all aspects of Big Oil and the influence of Big Oil companies on UK politics, UK working conditions, UK economy, given that they deal with, you know, the energetic lifeblood of this type of industrial capitalism, oil. And it's a very, very thorough investigation of them, and they are completely in bed with the government, you know. Revolving doors, civil servants going from the oil industry to the civil service, politicians from the oil industry and back into politics and da-da-da. Enormous entanglement, you know, corrupt entanglement, fascist, I would say, entanglement. I would say that country is fascist on that technical definition. You know, they're a fascist economy. It's one without any particular coherent political ideology other than to serve capital, which goes about its business through a complete entanglement, a complete enmeshment of corporate power and government power. And that is a much, much deeper corruption than these little individual corruptions, because it's right down in the nuts and bolts of the state. Even if Corbyn had won an election and tried to put his policies in, he'd have been against all that weight, the weight of the state, you know, the weight of the corporate state. Just capturing Parliament very often isn't enough to do it, you know, because the power's ranged against people trying to do that stuff. You know, I mean, even just a whiff of Corbyn, look at what's mobilised against him. All the mainstream media, at least half of his own party, you know, the opposition, you know, not the opposition, and the Tory party, obviously, all the gutter press owned by billionaires, who Corbyn was endlessly calling out, the whole kind of scam, the anti-Semitism scam, and it was a scam, it was an absolute tissue of reprehensible lies that in itself became anti-Semitic. All of that. And that was only, the guy only got like a sniff, got within sniffing distance of it, and look what they did. Even the Secretary of State of the US at the time, Mike Pompeo, basically issues a threat saying, well, if this guy gets in, we're going to have to do something about him. In fact, we'll try and stop him before he gets in. And he just said that boldly and baldly with a little smile on his face. He basically threatened the UK with regime change if they elected Corbyn. So, this is how deep the corruption is, and the essential corruption is state and corporate power being one and the same kind of thing through revolving doors, personnel, corruption, buying politics, buying influence, buying subsidies. Oil is still being subsidised, and gas, fossil fuels, being subsidised by us in the UK. After all the blather at all the blah blah, as Greta Thunberg called it, they're still there receiving billions and billions and billions week in, week out. That's the deep corruption. What we've seen here is just the tip of the iceberg. But really, we've got to capture the state and then we've got to reconfigure it at a very, very profound level. Yeah, you know, redesign, system redesign, including constitutional redesign. We need something like the Chilean settlement, in which people in the country vote to have a new constitution put together by an elected panel of citizens, you know, that can appoint its own expert guidance and so forth. Not by parliamentarians, by citizens, a special panel. Given the time and the space and the resources to do it, maybe over 5 years, because it's got to be a good job, because it's got to stand for 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 or 200 years. Really, a revolutionary rejig of the system, the economy, the modes of government, society itself, you know, and it also, as a part of that, rejigging all these awful class attitudes that still absolutely pollute the body politic. And those, I would say, the sort of bigger points to be drawn out. Just to reiterate, it's the system itself. Deeply, deeply, deeply flawed, because ridden with class attitudes, you know, and because it serves the trickle-up system of corporate capitalism, and because it operates through a complete entanglement of corporate power, in other words, capitalist power and state power, all in league with the mainstream media, which of course are agents of the same oligarchical class of 0.1%. And that is what you need to get from this. And of course, the big question that continues to hover over: why the fuck are we so supine as ordinary people? What is it persuades many, 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 many people that, you know, Boris is doing a good job when he clearly isn't, you know? Or that, well, you know, the poor old MPs, they need a bit of extra money. It's fair enough. That was kind of like Dunning-Kruger fucking Stockholm Syndrome attitude. Where do they come from, you know?
And are they going to last?
And are they going to last? I mean, I'm not going to stick my neck out and say whether we are on the cusp of a reversal here. And I think we could get a reversal here, but it could flip back in 6 months' time. There's some black swan event and the government acquits themselves with a modest amount of competence, you know, even that can turn, you know. They've got such a lot on their side, you know. I mean, not least the enormous donations they get for campaigning and such like, you know. But, yeah.
Although even with that, I can't see them getting very far if the likes of the Daily Mail and the Express really have turned against them, though.
Yeah, well, I think that this is a decision that has been made somewhere, you know, a directive almost has gone out. Not to get too conspiratorial, because they don't need directives, because they all think the same way, because they all have this same class attitude, this that Andrew Rosindell illustrated. They don't have to, you know, you don't have to have a directive from capitalist HQ. They just know what to do, because they are completely imbued to the point of unself-consciousness with the worldview and the attitudes, the class attitudes. It seems to me, at a juncture like this, really, that anybody with any kind of opposition to this, whether they're eco warriors or trade unionists or angry ordinary people, need to keep the pressure up on them, or intensify the pressure. If the organisation can happen to intensify the pressure, But at the moment, it looks like, I would say, they're working on having to replace Johnson at some point. Now, the mainstream media, I would think, didn't want to be hostage to fortune. They could see at some point that Johnson would fuck up too severely to be let off. And they want to be on the right side of history. They want to be able to say, we told you so. So they're kind of making sure that it happens, you know, or at least pushing in that direction, because the writing's been on the wall for some time. I know I've mentioned this once, but of course, you know, Rupert Murdoch has given Starmer his seal of approval. He's anointed him. Starmer kissed the ring.
And so what do you think Murdoch is expecting to get out of Starmer if he manoeuvres him into power?
Just, well, it was very useful from the point of view of the establishment, because it makes it look as though we live in a democracy, because look, we've changed things around. We let things change around. Things get changed around. Even though you won't be able to put a fag paper between between Starmer's policies and Johnson's policies.
Yeah.
It'll be a little bit friendlier. It'll be a little bit friendlier, but it'll still be basically managing capitalism. They're just going to say, we're going to manage capitalism better for you. And the people at the bottom end might get a few more crumbs from the table. And that'll be about it. They'll be as bad. They might even be worse. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher was absolutely awful, and we were euphoric when she got chucked out. John Major, the subsequent Tory Prime Minister, when they finally got thrown out and Blair got in. But for me, in my position as a public servant as I was at that time, things got worse very quickly. They wanted to sort of out neoliberal, the neoliberal Thatcherites. They wanted to prove to the corporate overlords, you know, that they could do it even, they could stamp on the underclass even more thoroughly. When you hear somebody like Rachel Reeve from the Labour Front, some time ago now, but saying, oh, if we get in power, we'll be even harder on benefit claimants. They've already got a punitive, Victorian, undeserving poor system, which is just cruel and inhuman. So, putting Starmer in, anointing him, allows the oligarchs, allows the establishment to perpetuate the illusion that we live in a democracy. You know, it's managed opposition. If we had, like, you know, if the Tories are in too long, you start thinking, oh, it's a dictatorship, it's all rigged. So let's get rid of them and have another lot. They aren't really going to do anything that different.
Just the same shit in a different dress.
Same shit in a different dress. So that they can get away with saying, well, but you live in a democracy, you voted. You know, because if we all then take to the streets, they turn around and say, but you voted. Why do you need to take to the streets? We let you vote. That's what all that is about. And it's carefully managed. It's managed opposition, folks. So there's some things to take away from this little local story and throwing up some questions. How does the brainwashing work? And bringing out some points. The chief one, I would say, is that it just goes far, far deeper, and it's not new. It's actually intrinsic to the fucking setup, the whole kind of setup of UK society and the UK political life.
Okay, so I hope everyone found that interesting and maybe useful. And we will speak to you again soon.
Hope you're all having a good apocalypse. Make knowledge great again.